Blog Talk Radio.
Good evening. Welcome to the March 3rd edition of The Notes with your host, D.R. Tucker of drtucker.blog.friendster.com and massachusettsmadras.com. To join in, you can call 347-857-3578. That's 347-857-3578. Joining us now is author Stephen L. Pease. He is currently the co-chairman of the U.S.-Russia Foundation for Economic Advancement and the Rule of Law and the chairman of the U.S.-Russia Investment Fund. His new book is entitled The Golden Age of Jewish Achievement. It's a pleasure to have Mr. Pease with us tonight. Stephen, are you there?
Yes, I am, and thanks very much for inviting me.
Yes, and congratulations on an excellent book. At the beginning of the book, you note, quote, "A Presbyterian by upbringing of Scots, Irish, English, and German heritage, I do not claim Jewish genes. Nevertheless, Jews have played a long and important role in my life," unquote. When was the first time you became aware of the adversity Jews faced around the world?
Well, probably in college, because some of my college classmates there and in business school talked a little bit about it. And then, of course, as a student, I tended to read fairly widely. And, when you started to get into some of the books about what happened during World War II and what later became known as the Holocaust, you couldn't have read it without understanding at least that part of the hardship. Now, the other parts of the hardship, you know, the diaspora and what the Romans did came much later in life. But I certainly had an early exposure how difficult life had been if you're a Jew.
You discussed the late Richard Feynman, who was a co-winner of the Nobel Prize in Physics in 1965. Julian Swinger, who shared the 1965 Nobel Prize win, described Feynman as a, quote, "honest man, the outstanding intuitionalist of our age, rather, and a prime example of what may lie in store for anyone who dares to follow the beat of a different drummer," unquote. How influential was Mr. Feynman in the scientific world?
You know, there are people that say that the lectures that are done at Caltech that he put down in a book are still used to this day, probably 35, 40 years later, as kind of the guiding reference for teaching certain parts of physics. He played a long role. He also was important in the Challenger disaster. You know, he was the guy who would explain in front of an audience exactly why the Challenger explosion had occurred. But, you know, your quote there is also interesting because a lot of people thought of him as not somebody who thought in kind of a linear 1-2-3-4 fashion, but that he really was an intuitionist. He really intuited all these insights that he had to the world of physics. He was a remarkable person, probably one of the brightest guys who worked on the Manhattan Project and was acknowledged by Oppenheimer.
Mm. As you note in your book, when asked to explain in a few words what he had accomplished, he said, quote, "Buddy, if I could tell you in a minute what I had done, it would not be worth the Nobel Prize," unquote. That's a great line.
Well, you know, and it's also telling. I mean, if you're operating on intuition, it's a little harder to explain how you got there, but if you think in linear terms, it's a little easier.
The late Edwin Land also had a profound impact on the scientific world. You note that Mr. Land was, quote, "America's second most prolific inventor with 535 patents to his name," unquote. Does the average American realize just how significant of a role Mr. Land played in the realm of photography?
You know, I think I do because I grew up in the era of the Polaroid Land camera, and I was used to kind of the Brownie Hawkeye where you'd send the negatives away for a week and a half and get them back. And he, because of the inspiration caused by his daughter, thought through and came up with the notion of how to do instant photography. And I saw it firsthand when we bought a Land camera. But I think a lot of people don't know that in addition to that, I mean, he was instrumental in the design of the U-2, the aircraft that was used for spy purposes. He came up with kind of a color video arrangement much before everybody else. I mean, as you said, right behind Thomas Alva Edison is Edwin Land, and a lot of the work he did with polarizing, kind of which was his early specialty. He never graduated from Harvard because he was so bright he was coming up with ideas more quickly than the academic regime would handle. And in fact, his teacher became one of his employees in this company that Land started. He, very innovative guy, not very well known these days.
As you note, although he never graduated from college, quote, he received at least 10 honorary doctorates, including one from Harvard where he had been a student. He was admitted as a Fellow of England's Royal Society, was a Fellow of the National Academy of Sciences, and served as President of the American Academy of Arts and Sciences. Taken together, Land was an exceptional achiever. He was a prolific inventor and scientist, a successful entrepreneur, an advisor to presidents and Congress, a benefactor of education, and a firm believer in truth.
Absolutely. And a guy who quite publicly broke away from Nixon because he believed that Nixon was not interested in the truth.
You discussed the so-called Jewish quotas that were once used in American universities to restrict the number of Jews that could be admitted. Back in November 1998, Pat Buchanan wrote a controversial column entitled The Disposition of Christian Americans, in which he noted that Jews constituted about 30% of the Harvard student body despite being less than 3% of the U.S. population, and suggested that Christians should be allotted 75% of the seats at Harvard. Was Buchanan subtly suggesting that the Jewish quotas should be brought back?
You know, I don't have a clue. I mean, you can read that quote in a variety of ways. I mean, it might have been tongue-in-cheek. I followed Buchanan's career, but like I say, I don't know that he would have seriously advocated that. I mean, certainly, I think that would be one of the stupidest things in the world you could do. The story of them getting to 22% or 30% is a remarkable aspect of why I wrote this book. Here's a group of people that arrived mostly illiterate in the United States between 1880 and 1924, thought to have been illiterate, known to have been illiterate, and thought to have been low IQ, and they put testing in to kind of see whether or not these people could compete. And within a generation, they were 22% of the student body at Harvard, they were 40% of the student body at Columbia, they were 80% of the student body at Hunter College. They just were driven to achieve, and education was such an important part of the culture, they were driven to get an education, and they did. The quotas came because they were doing that so effectively, people were fearful, and in fact, first use of the term diversity came in the context of geographic diversity, which was kind of a code word for let's have fewer people from the Lower East Side as a part of the student body. But education, you've read the book, the education is a vital part of this culture, and it's part of the reason that they have been so successful, despite attempts to limit their numbers in the Ivy League.
With regards to the I read the piece, and I thought he was being deadly serious, and at the time it was noted that Buchanan was almost warping the whole argument against quota-based affirmative action programs, basically, that admission should be based on merit, and if Jews had achieved based on merit positions disproportionate to their level of the population, there's nothing inherently wrong with that.
Well, absolutely. I mean, I think if Buchanan was serious, he goes down a number of notches in my mind for kind of intellectual rigor. I mean, that just sounds like, you know, I want my crowd to win whether or not they're worth it or not.
Yeah. You discussed the legacy of the late economist Milton Friedman, noting his, quote, iconoclastic bent and his ability to forcefully and convincingly argue in favor of ideas for which he was typically the only visible advocate, unquote. Would there even be a conservative movement in this country were it not for the work of Mr. Friedman?
Well, the honest answer is I don't know, but the odds are if there was one, it would have been much weaker. I mean, he and William F. Buckley probably as much as anybody, and maybe more than almost anybody, kind of reacted. I mean, I can remember when I was in college, Friedman was just kind of freshly on the scene, and his views were really considered remarkably controversial. You know, we would read about him in college, but he was, as time passed, more and more of his views were proven to be correct, and of course he was rigorous in the idea that it isn't enough just to have a theory, you have to look at the evidence of whether or not the theory pans out. And he kind of single-handedly made that part of economic orthodoxy is that you have to prove your point. You know, if you look today at modern-day Chile is one of, you know, he gets criticized for what people say he did in Chile, but Chile is the most successful economic power south of the Rio Grande.
As you note, he counseled Chile, one of Latin America's few economic bright spots since the late 1970s. Argentina, which ultimately adopted his privatization suggestions, used the proceeds from the sale of state-owned companies to finance enlarged government spending, and of course Argentina has since faced continuing economic problems.
Absolutely. I mean, I think you're right that most people only know the part of the story where they privatized things. They don't know where the proceeds went, and what they did was subsidize some spending that just plain couldn't be continued when they ran out of things to privatize. Argentina's gone from being a first world power to a third world power in 100 years.
Do you think Friedman deserves any credit for the fact that there was less devastation in Chile in the wake of the recent earthquake than there was in Haiti, for example?
Yeah. I mean, you can argue that the discipline that he brought, the economic success that they had, allowed them to raise the standard of construction. And it appears from everything we can see right now that wasn't just on paper that they did that. They did that in reality. So what have you got? Maybe 700, 800 deaths down there compared to, what, 220,000 in Haiti?
Yeah.
For an 8.8 magnitude quake? I mean, there's no doubt that those earthquake standards have made an immense difference. Their economic prosperity counted in that.
You know that Democratic Senator Dianne Feinstein of California grew up in a rather dysfunctional family, but she, quote, transformed her family difficulties into a steely but velvet-gloved determination that has manifested itself ever since, unquote. Would you consider Senator Feinstein a rigid ideologue, or is she actually a pragmatist?
You know, it's interesting. Having spent much of my life in Northern California, I think of her as a pragmatist. I mean, she will tend to hew the party line often, but she's very thoughtful. You know, and when she ran San Francisco, she did an awfully good job. If she was to run for Senate out here, I think a lot of people, Republican, like myself, would be inclined to consider her as a serious candidate. I mean, everything that she's done, she usually thinks through, she usually explains. You don't have to agree with her on all points, but you rarely find her just kind of digging in our heels on an ideological basis without at least having considered the alternatives on the other side or the arguments on the other side.
Now, what about her fellow Democratic Senator Barbara Boxer?
I don't know. Barbara Boxer is a very smart lady, and she can be very charming on occasion, but I do tend to find her even more of an ideologue, and she tends to kind of dig in her heels. Tends to have a point of view, and you know, who knows? I think out here in California, there's a view that in the next election, she's probably more vulnerable than Dianne would be for the same seat if they were both running simultaneously. I think Barbara Boxer's like to have a fight on her hands. She's smart, she's tough, and she's wily, but I think she comes at it with a less than pragmatic point of view.
Have you ever had a chance to meet her, and if so, did you address her as senator or ma'am?
Not after I saw the general on the stand, I certainly wouldn't. Yeah, no, no, I have never met Barbara Boxer. I have met Dianne Feinstein one time, just very briefly, but no, I've not met her.
You write that the retired baseball star Sandy Koufax, quote, was a remarkable mix. His style of pitching was determined and aggressive, yet gentle was the word most often used to describe him, unquote. Where would you rank Koufax on the list of the greatest baseball players of all time?
Well, you're kind of going over my head in terms of my intimate knowledge of baseball. My stepson and my son-in-law could both give this right down to three decimal places. He clearly, in my mind, has to be one of the top 50. I mean, he was a remarkably successful pitcher, a very good pitcher. He got there from determination. In his prime, nobody could do a better job. I mean, I was in Spokane and in San Francisco, so the L.A. Dodgers were sometimes the enemy. But he was a remarkable man, and part of the reason I wrote about him was not just because he was so determined that people could talk about how tough he was on the mound, but when everybody that she interviewed about that book came away with a very positive, thoughtful impression of what a nice guy this guy was, and the way he chose not to exploit his talent or his notoriety, I just found an amazing story. Of the people in the book, he's got to be very high on the list of the ones that I would love to meet.
With regard to Barbara Streisand, you note, quote, if Streisand has been generous with her political opinions and democratic fundraising, she has been equally philanthropic for causes in the United States and Israel, unquote. Considering the extent of her charitable work, is it wrong for conservatives to regard her as just another self-absorbed Hollywood liberal?
I think so. I mean, I think Barbara Streisand and I would probably sit down and disagree 80% of the time, and yet her performance, what she's done with her life and her career, and the way she devotes so much of her money and her time to charitable causes, you can't look at that and not be impressed. I mean, I tried to explain what I thought was brilliant about her, some things about her that are controversial, but you can't walk away from her and not be remarkably impressed.
As much as I dislike her political opinions, I'll give her credit for one thing. You know the musical group Steely Dan, the 70s music group?
Sure.
Yeah, she gave those guys their first big break because she did a song called I Mean to Shine on her album in 1971, and that was their first credited, the two leaders of Steely Dan, Donald Fagen and Walter Becker, that was their first credited song, and that helped basically put them on the map. So I'll always cut her a bit of slack for that.
Yeah, I mean, absolutely. She's a fascinating lady. My guess is if she and I sat down and we just kind of agreed that we were going to disagree, she would be a fascinating lady to talk to. I mean, she's just got a very interesting background. She's very determined. She's done lots of great things. I don't think there's a performer who has quite, you know, a stage performer who has quite as many accolades behind her from the movies through different kinds of performance art.
45 minutes past the hour. Again, our number is 347-857-3578. Our guest, author Stephen Peace, the author of The Golden Age of Jewish Achievement. After NBC founder David Sarnoff passed away in December 1971, the New York Times wrote that Sarnoff was, quote, not an inventor, nor was he a scientist, but he was a man of outstanding vision who was able to see with remarkable clarity the possibilities of harnessing the electron, unquote. Should Sarnoff be considered America's first multimedia mogul?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I think he's the guy who conceived of what a broadcast network was, or how it should work and how the pieces would fit together. I mean, even before that, he saw the technology when he was with Marconi and saw that it could be more than just kind of ship to shore. It could be more than just dots and dashes. And the minute you could put voice over wireless, it could be more than just a one-to-one kind of a phenomenon. It could be a broadcast. And he saw that and wrote to his bosses about it, and it took a long time for them to see his vision. Once they did, he was the guy who had a chance to implement it, and he did it both in radio and later in television. I mean, the way the industry is structured, until the advent of cable TV, really was all his doing. And today, even cable TV, they're broadcast networks. They just go over direct pipes as opposed to over the airwaves.
In discussing the achievements of Jews in the private sector, you note, quote, the U.S. has been among the least discriminatory countries in the world for Jews. That history has nonetheless had its ups and downs, unquote. You also note that for years there was, quote, subtle anti-Semitism which kept Jews from senior management positions and off boards of directors in selected industries and companies, unquote. Jewish businessmen and businesswomen broken through this particular glass ceiling?
Would you repeat the question just again? It was a little bit foggy.
Have they broken through in recent years? Yes.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, that whole chapter that I wrote on the Fortune 500 CEOs was intended to get at that. I mean, if you look at the successful Jews in industry and commerce at the turn of the century, 1900 to 1920, you see a lot of them. But what you see is that they were all entrepreneurs. These were all guys who built their own company almost from scratch, or came from families that built them from scratch. But if you do the same thing in 1997, you begin to see guys like Louis Plath, who ran Hewlett-Packard, Shapiro, who ran DuPont, you know, a company that was virtually family-run for hundreds of years. You look at the guys who Kaminsky, who is the president, I think, of Merrill Lynch. I think from roughly 1980, 85, maybe just a shade before that, the issue of, you know, our crowd, meaning I don't mean that in the Jewish sense, but I mean that in the white shoe, Morgan Stanley, WASPy banker, and that they were the guys who were going to occupy the corporate offices in America, that diminished. It took time. Michael Eisner helped make it happen. But Jews moved into the corner office, were accepted in the corner office. In the country clubs of the United States, Jews were invited to become members. The walls broke down. I mean, it's one of the reasons that I've become proud of the United States is, you know, we are the most accepting, and we kind of accept this diversity, and we really treasure it. And it took a long time for Jews. I mean, they started coming here 1654, for gosh sakes. But in the last 30 or 40 years, they've also moved into the corner offices.
When I read that chapter, I think to myself, in terms of the progress they've made, it's really a tribute to American exceptionalism, if you think about it.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, you know, I think Obama's right. Sometimes we come across to the world as being a little too proud. But I travel a lot. And when I go to some countries that think that they're very, very broad-minded, and then I look at some, you know, a lot of these countries who have that view are monoculture. They have a single religion, they have a single ethnic group, they have a single this. They don't appreciate that we really are kind of the melting pot and have been from inception, and it's part of what's made America great. And so I think we've been blessed to have our Jews, just as we've been blessed to have our Germans, our Irish, our Blacks, all these other cultures. It's part of what makes us different, and it's part of what I think makes us great.
You note that American businessman Julius Rosenwald, quote, may qualify as the original compassionate conservative. A successful Republican, Rosenwald opposed FDR's New Deal politics and his approach to welfare. Nonetheless, Rosenwald alone was responsible for the construction of more than 5,000 black schools built throughout the South between 1916 and 1932, unquote. Should he be considered one of the unsung heroes of the civil rights movement?
Well, I mean, as you probably know, the NAACP was started largely by Jews and then later migrated to black control. But yes, mm-hmm. I mean, Rosenwald was a guy who built an immense fortune because what he did with Sears and Roebuck was simply astonishing. He built it into something arguably bigger than what Walmart is today. But even when he really couldn't afford to do it, he and his wife became very philanthropic, and somehow he ends up on the board of Tuskegee. And all of a sudden, he realizes that the educational opportunities for blacks in the South is simply abysmal. They're spending a fraction of the amount of money they spend on white schools, and he decides to do something about it. And so he commissions the preparation of a set of architectural plans that can be used all over the South, and he sets up a deal with the black parents saying, look, I'll tell you what, you can put sweat equity into this thing. I'm not going to write the check for all of it, but you can contribute to this whole thing. And he finds a few other people that are willing to throw in money, and he literally shames the school boards in the Southern South into coming up with the money. When the smoke cleared, I think he put up something like 23 or 24% of the money, but it was his effort that caused all 5,000 of those schools to be built. And he did it in the context of a guy who thought Franklin Roosevelt's welfare state policies were wrong, were wrong-headed. It's part of the reason I think of him as a compassionate conservative, because this was kind of in the early days of kind of Bush, where everybody thought compassionate conservative probably was baloney. And yet here's a real live guy who made a bloody fortune, who didn't go along with the welfare state, but did provide compassionate support to help build all those black schools throughout the South. So I just found him just another remarkable person.
Reading that piece about Mr. Rosenwald and just reading the whole section about Jewish involvement in the civil rights movement, it just horrifies you again, or horrified me, to think about the horrible spate that existed for years and years about black anti-Semitism. The late Eric Brindell of the New York Post, he used to write a lot of columns about this theme of how odd it was that, considering how much Jews had done to advance the civil rights movement, that in the late 1980s you had this unprecedented escalation in black anti-Semitism. It just reading it just disturbed me all over again, and I thought back to Brindell's columns and how sad it was that, you know, good deeds went unpunished, so to speak.
I agree, and I'm old enough to remember before that was the case. You know, when the Jews were actively trying to help the black movement all over the United States, and relations were more friendly. But when it turned south very hard and very quickly. And, you know, they were accused of exploiting, because they were often the owners of property in black neighborhoods, and they ran some of the shops in black neighborhoods, and it was nonsensical. I mean, in the totality, some of the people who were working the hardest to help blacks through that era were Jews.
Mm-hmm. Well, finally, you write, quote, the notion that Jewish achievement might simply be attributable to good fortune can be dismissed out of hand. Were they disproportionately accomplished in one or two fields, perhaps, but across the range described by this book, it is simply impossible, unquote. In your view, what exactly explains this tremendous level of achievement?
If we have another half hour, I could begin to touch it. I mean, I think what I'm really saying with the book is that you have a culture that is, in part, it's based upon the religion, but in part, it's also based on historical circumstance. For example, you know, Jews did write down the Torah. They had five books of the Bible, and mostly they were written down early on, and that demanded a certain amount of literacy. But probably what demanded literacy even more than the fact that the Torah was in writing and people had to be able to read it was the Roman diaspora. You know, the Jews got clobbered by the Romans from 70 AD to 165 AD, and they chose then, after they killed roughly a million of them, to disperse most of the rest of them all over the planet. And I think the elders of Judaism realized that if they were going to keep the tribe and the religion and the culture alive, they had to have everything that they believed in writing. The oral law, which had previously just been oral, had to be in writing. They had to finish what they called the Tanakh, or the Old Testament. And if you're going to put it in writing, it had to be read. It had to be debated. It had to be understood. And that was vital if you're going to have people in enclaves, tiny enclaves, all over the planet. So they made education mandatory. It was the first tribe in the history of the world to make education mandatory. And they've stuck with it for 2,000 years. In 1,000, Maimonides is admonishing communities, saying, if you don't have schools, we're just going to banish you from the religion. He was saying the same thing to families. You know, they made education vital. And it's just one example of something that arose from the religion, but also arose from the culture that they treasure. And, I mean, you can see the results today. When you know, half of the Ivy League presidents today are Jewish. It's down from 5 of 8 a generation ago, or the prior generation of CEOs, and they're 22% of the student body in the Ivy League schools. It's vitally important to them. But, you know, there's other things. That, you know, they believe in progress. Ethical monotheism says that you've got to do right and live a moral life. They believe that actions count more than words. Action counts, to some extent, more than faith in their religion. It's what you do in this life that matters. There's a whole host of cultural phenomena, but I think the culture, for me, is the best single explanation for why this thing has occurred the way it has. And as you implied, I mean, from my standpoint, it's part of the reason the book is written, is because, I mean, I'm certainly lauding the Jews, and I occasionally get criticized for doing that by a certain group of people who may be sensitive about that. But the bottom line is, my message is other people can do the same thing.
I think it comes down to, and I guess this would be considered controversial in some circles, I do think it comes down to education and IQ, basically. I think that you have, when you have intellectual gifts and you're motivated to use those intellectual gifts and to work to develop those intellectual gifts, only good things can result.
Absolutely. I mean, there is a... Charles Murray probably has written one of the best papers on using the IQ argument, the intellectual argument. And what he's saying is that the diaspora killed a million Jews, but you can't explain the decline in the number of Jews based solely on Jews having been killed by the Romans. In fact, this demand for education for a population that at the time were really farmers essentially caused them to self-select for a group of people that were willing to do the education, who had some talent for doing that, and over the generations between 70 AD, and now they tended to self-select for high IQ, those people who were most willing to put in the time and the energy. But there's still a cultural component. I mean, IQ is not just strictly fixed. It isn't fixed the instant you're born. I mean, the data seem to suggest that there is a malleability there. And so between that malleability and culture, you know, you can argue that the reason that a lot of Jews have high IQ is because the culture made them do it. The culture caused it to happen.
Well, thanks again to Stephen L. Pease for joining us tonight to discuss his extraordinary new book, The Golden Age of Jewish Achievement. To read more about his book, please visit www.goldenageofjewishachievement.com. So what's next in store, Stephen?
Now I get to go back to worrying about what we're doing in Russia, because I'm heavily involved in that. And I've also got some involvements here in Sonoma. And interestingly enough, one of those has to do with education, where we really want to upgrade the caliber of education and the motivation of our kids in education, because in the long run, that's really what matters.
Exactly. I'm 100% in agreement with you. Well, thanks so much again for joining us tonight.
My pleasure, and thanks very much.
Thanks. And please be sure to join us next week, and remember to always stay focused on the focus.